And reflecting on what it might be useful for us to reflect on tonight, it occurred to me that since we're in one of these sort of Hallmark card holidays, that maybe we could spend a little bit of time together reflecting on parenting. Parenting and what Tara Brach, a Dharma teacher in this tradition, calls re-parenting. Start off, which is probably as good a place as any in a Dharma group, and what the Buddha had to say about parenting. And among the things that he had to say was this. He said, whether you consider yourself to have been parented well or not, there is no way that you will ever know the full extent to which sacrifices were made in order for you to have been raised. And the greatest gift, of course, that your parents gave you is the fact that you're here. Okay. Because from the Buddhist view, in terms of the path to awakening, you know, there are several different levels of existence that are posited. And the only, you know, it's like these little, like walking the maze or something like that. You know, there's these different levels you can be at and different paths you can walk. But in terms of the ultimate goal of full awakening, full enlightenment, that the only form in which that can take is human form. Okay. So in order to have the opportunity for awakening, you need to be in human form. So, from that view, then that gift in of itself is one for which great gratitude is to be generated. Okay. So, in my own study and practice of the Dharma, relationships with parents turn out to be something that was quite significant. And for actually quite a while in my practice, something of a working edge. So, and when I married, and my wife Abby and I were kind of reflecting on our growing up and whatnot. Our growing up was really quite different in some ways. You know, she grew up in a very stable household where, and she was an only child, and her parents devoted quite a lot of time and attention to her, and she always felt safe and well cared for and whatnot during all the time that she was growing up. And she continued to have sort of warm, ongoing relationships with her folks pretty much for all of her adult life until they passed away. And that was not the case for me. My very early years were happy ones, but my parents' marriage, by and large, was not a happy one. And they tended to be, both individually, they both tended to be rather self-recriminatory. And then as their relationship began to deteriorate, they decided maybe it would help things if they had a couple more kids. Did not turn out to be the case. In fact, it seemed to kind of make matters worse. At least in my view, because they were both about 10 years younger than me, and quality of my Christmas presents took a nosedive. And and then the year I graduated from high school was also the year my folks got divorced, and I went into the service. And I came to realize as I was entering young adulthood and onward that there were quite a lot of things that I didn't care for about myself, about how I treated myself, about how I treated others and whatnot. And as I kind of looked at those, I realized that a lot of them felt to me like I had inherited them. And so I've spent quite a while feeling, you know, again, this is probably not all that uncommon for teenagers and young adults, you know, feeling sort of resentful at my folks for being who they were, essentially. And then as I grew on into adulthood, and especially after I began to study and practice the Buddha Dharma, insight meditation in particular, I'd go on retreat and I'd reflect on sort of what was going on in my life and my view of myself and the world and others and whatnot. And came to realize that this, you know, this sort of undercurrent or continuing theme of self-aversion or self-recrimination was actually something that was really woven very deeply into the fabric of my family life from early on. Furthermore, we belong to a fairly fundamentalist Christian church in which that was the name of the game, you know, of starting out flawed and only by the grace of a deistic authority figure might you be saved and made whole and clean and whatnot. And as a result of that, I came to, as I was struggling with my own stuff, as I was sitting in meditation, I came to see that quite a lot of it really did have to do with my experience of growing up and my relationship with my parents, and that in order for the Dharma to be able to work its magic, to allow it to do, allow its true healing potential to be realized, that I really needed to focus in on that dynamic, on what was going on. And so there was something that I, you know, as I became a little bit more experienced and mature in Dharma practice and understanding, and really coming to live the truth that suffering is the gateway to compassion, and that through careful, open examination, inquiry into the nature of my own dukkha on retreat, that, you know, having the willingness to do that in and of itself in retreat setting within the context of Buddha Dharma does indeed begins to generate and to bring forth a sense of compassion, you know, for oneself and for others as well. And so in the practice of, you know, what we call the Brahma Viharas, the four immeasurable, the divine abidings, you know, that have to do with the engendering of, the generation of, the summoning forth of compassion and of selfless joy and of equanimity and of open-heartedness, you know, that one of the traditional ways in which that practice is done, especially among monastics, is that, and in Southeast Asia, it's kind of the home base of the Theravada tradition, on the full moon night, they would have, I learned this from sitting with Sharon Salzberg, saying that they would have this ceremony of atonement, or ceremony of reconciliation, because, you know, living in community as it works, stuff happens, you know. You get on somebody's wrong side or they get on yours and conflicts arise and whatnot. And so what's supposed to go on in this ceremony on the full moon night is anybody else in the community that you got issues with, okay, you're supposed to approach them and say, for any ways that I may have caused you harm, by reason of anything that I've thought or said or done, I ask your forgiveness. And for any ways you may have harmed me in that manner, I forgive you as well. And then if it's in the other person's heart, they do the same thing. You know, for any ways that you may have harmed me, either knowingly or unknowingly, through anything you've thought or said or done, I forgive you. And for any ways that I may have harmed you, by reason of anything that I've thought or said or done, I ask your forgiveness. And when it works right, it kind of keeps the community in harmony. And it keeps all the members of the community in touch with themselves, because they kind of know, you know, if they feel like they've been wronged or hurt, and who they consider the author of that to be, and also acknowledging ways they may have caused some problem for others. And so one of the things that I decided to experiment with doing by way of trying to get right, you know, with my past, you know, and like Jack Kornfield says, you know, letting go of your suffering involves giving up all hope of ever having had a better past. You need to make peace with, you know, where you came from, make peace with your past karma. You know? So I decided to experiment by using those phrases of atonement to forgive my parents, right? So what I began by doing was forgiving them for not being perfect, for not being the absolute perfect parent at all times, okay? For not having adequately protected me from the slings and arrows of outrageous circumstance, you know, for not having adequately protected me from suffering, right? You brought me into this world, you know, and really crappy things have happened, and it must be your fault, it must be somebody's fault, probably yours, right? So, first forgiving them for not being perfect, okay? And then forgiving them for not having been wiser and kinder and not having shielded me from all evil, you know. And as I would do that, now it sounds a little humorous, but basically what I would, in so doing, what I realized is that at some deep level, you know, I expected them to be perfect. I expected them to always be open-hearted and wise and compassionate, you know, and basically superhuman, you know, deific, holy, right? And they weren't. They were just folks in the world, just like me, you know. So, yes, forgive them for not being demigods. That was the first thing, okay. And that helped me to kind of get in touch with my own expectations a little bit of what I wanted as a child, but that perhaps never was able to give up on. And then forgiving him for suffering that I experienced at the hands of the world. That was one of the things that gave me the greatest misgivings in terms of the possibility of becoming a parent myself, you know, it was a few years before, you know, my wife and I decided that, you know, she had wanted to have kids from the get-go, and I was not too interested. And it had to do with our respective experiences growing up. And it wasn't until after we did our first retreat together, actually, that we came to one accord in terms of having kids. And the reason was because I didn't want to bring beings into the world who were going to have to suffer. But it was only after that first retreat I realized, well, you know, that's kind of how it works. You do your best, and then at some point they go forth into the world and they experience the world as it is. And that just kind of needed to be accepted. And then there was another layer of experiences that I had growing up, you know, where on reflection I could clearly see that there were things that both of my parents did at various times that were really quite unskillful, okay? That really were harmful. And that I carried with me the effects of that. You know, it was kind of a karmic imprint that I had to carry forth, and that really did have some formative influences on my personality and my view of the world and things that needed to be worked out. It was that level of forgiveness that, to some extent, I continue to practice, actually. My dad's been dead now for close to 20 years, and my mom for about 3 or 4 now, okay? But there is this saying in Buddha Dharma, put no one out of your heart, right? And so even though they're no longer here, one of the important elements in my own practice is to remember from time to time not to put them out of my heart, not to put their memory out of my heart, you know, because my experience growing up with them and knowing them, the really powerfully positive attributes of who I am that they contributed to and that they helped make possible and they sacrificed for, you know, as well as some of the things that on reflection I continue to view as unskillful, right? It's all part of the same thing. And it was only by coming to a full and complete acceptance of that fact in terms of who they were, warts and all, that began to contribute to my own ability to relate to myself in the same way. It felt like there was some way that I needed to unreservedly forgive them in order to be able to unreservedly forgive myself for the unskillful things that I've thought and said and done over the years as well. So making peace with the memory of my parents turned out to be fairly instrumental in making peace with myself as well. I'd like to stop now. You know, there are other things I want to say, but first I'd rather just spend a little bit of time together asking whether anything that I've said so far resonates with you at all, whether or not it has any relationship to, you know, what your own background may have been like. And if so, for anyone who might want to share just a little, I'd really love to hear either just your comments or if you have some question about that as well. Yes, please.
I found recently that I've been sort of struggling with my two brothers' lives and learning to bring them into my field of healing, you know, what I learned from the practice, not to mention years of therapy.
Yes.
That, you know, that's where I seem to be at a total loss. The three of us, you know, were impacted by the same rather significantly dysfunctional family. And I see them still self-destructing, and I'm at a loss. I mean, you know, any attempt to broach the subject just... So I like what you said, and I've been doing that sort of imagining them in my heart.
Well, with our siblings, we shared the experience, you know, we all shared the ups and downs of whatever was going on in the family and whatnot, and we all had to come to terms with it. We all had to figure out how to deal with it in one way or another. And, you know, I've talked with my own brother and sister about this kind of thing from time to time, and you know, the Buddha actually remonstrated against proselytizing, trying to convince other people that your view or your path is the correct one, but also being open to talk about it, you know. And so both my brother and my sister have chosen other paths or other ways to work it out. And when I kind of edged towards every once in a while trying to do a little backdoor dharma, you know, I came to realize that was not necessarily real skillful, you know, that we each hold those experiences a little differently, and we each have to resolve them in a way that works for us. You know, I guess as much as most of us can do is simply witness what's working for us to the extent that we find our views or our practice to be of a healing nature, and then, you know, they need to sort it out for themselves. Thank you very much. Please.
I could relate very much to what you said. I feel like I've spent a lot of time and energy in my life trying to resolve the unskillfulness, or a lot of the unskillfulness that my parents showed in the raising of me and my siblings too. And I guess I'm wondering if is there any literature that you could recommend about forgiveness? I mean, forgiving your parents Because I really, really like that idea. That sounds so healing.
Yes.
And I wanna be more in that space than remembering with resentment. Things that happened when I was raised. I would really like to get beyond that and forgive, really forgive.
Right.
And heal. So if you have any literature or rituals even that you've used in your forgiveness of your parents, I'd like to know about it.
Those phrases that I repeated a few moments ago, that's my own practice as far as that's concerned. And actually, this talk's being recorded. It's going to get posted up on our website, so you can listen to it again sometime if you want. And a lot of the things, among the readings that I turn to for things like this, I'm very fond of this book by Tara Brach, Radical Acceptance. She looks at those things a fair amount in a very skillful way, and she's got exercises in there. So I would definitely look to that as a possible, instructor, set of instructions as well. Yeah, thank you. So, yeah.
I was applying what you said about parents to my own children.
Yes.
Because I had certain judgments around what they did. One of my daughters got pregnant in her senior year in high school, and I thought that was unskillful to underestimate the way I felt at the time. And yet, for her, it's been an enormous gift. She matured from it. She just blossomed from this. So I realize that in my own life, I'm not sure what the gift is and what the trial is.
Yes.
Then they switch.
Yeah.
And so it was helpful to me in forgiving myself. So
of course, good. I appreciate you sharing that. Yes, please, in the back.
Yeah. Maybe this is a cop out, but I've heard, in terms of meditating on people and these things, that, you kind of start with some of the easier stuff, and maybe not shooting for the direct target of forgiveness tends to be a way that you can work on that larger piece. Can you speak more about that?
Yes. The way I usually sequence this teaching is that every fall I do a month-long series on sort of introduction to Buddhism and mindfulness meditation practice. And then the following month, usually November, we do a whole month on just the Brahma Viharas, the cultivation of, of the qualities of compassion, selfless joy, equanimity, and open heart love, And the way the Buddha actually taught those practices was just, he only actually provided phrases for the metta, the loving kindness part, but of simply radiating outward in all directions from the heart, these feelings. In the Burmese tradition, tied with a set of commentaries called the Vasuddhimagga, the Path of Purification, it's in that text that, and this is kind of a user's guide to the Pali Canon, it was written about 1,000 years after the Buddha died. That's where this technique of doing this stepwise offering of loving kindness, offering it first to yourself, then to a spiritual benefactor, a dear friend, neutral person, what's called a difficult person, someone you're having trouble with, right? And the idea there is, just as you say, you work up to it. So just as if you're taking, if you're a beginning student in a yoga class, it's not skillful at all to try to force your body into exactly the same postures as a yoga teacher, because you hurt yourself. And the same as you were pointing out, if you start off trying to, send loving kindness to the most difficult person and you find that you can't do it, then that oftentimes can become a source of self-recrimination, self-judgment. I ought to be able to offer loving kindness to that person, but I can't. Especially if it's somebody who in your experience or your view has traumatized you in some way, psychologically or physically or both, or just to whom you attribute a lot of your suffering. And so trying to force yourself beyond that, to that point or beyond that point, not so helpful. And then, so just offering that, those things to yourself first is much more skillful. And if for whatever reason you can't even do that, then that's sometimes where the compassion can come forth, because to not be able to offer loving kindness to yourself is a painful experience, right? And so just to be able to be with the difficulty, whatever it is, in a way that is, what the practice, you know, in the greater discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, the establishing of mindfulness, the Buddha says, you know, the meditator knows the contracted mind to be the contracted mind, knows the expanded mind to be the expanded mind. When he's talking about the practice of metta, the reason that's sometimes called the four immeasurables is because what you're doing is radiating outward in all directions beyond the bounds of the constructed self. These feelings of compassion, selfless joy, equanimity, love. And eventually it comes to touch those you did not think it could. But it can't do that until it's pretty strong at the core. And so that's why you always start for yourself and you work with yourself. And then who knows what may fall. Is that responsive? Yeah, good, thank you. So there is, yeah, please.
In keeping with what you led off with, when I go through this, I really focus on my own requests for forgiveness. I think of my parents, and I think of the sacrifices that they took on. It grounds me a little more when I realize that they were equally disappointed, perhaps, in their own personal lives, and disappointed in perhaps some of the horizons they weren't able to go after because they had two young ones that they had to take care of. And it gives me a little bit more understanding when I get to a point where I have to reach in and say, can I forgive you for perhaps your unskillful ways, when I realize that my own unskillful ways challenge them well beyond perhaps what reason would require.
Sure, sure, you know, most of us probably were not a joy to grow up with. There are probably so many ways that we made life miserable for our parents without even knowing it, you know, at the time. Because it's just the nature of, you know, the young mind.
Little shit.
So, yes. Yeah, please.
I realized recently, thinking about my dad, who I've been very judgmental about, I thought about his life, and I thought, it must have taken, I mean, he was really very much abused. He was, he had a very violent father. And I realized it must have taken amazing strength on his part not to beat us.
Not to replicate that behavior. Right.
He was very withdrawn, but I think that was probably the way he managed it.
One of the things we'll probably never know is the extent to which they were struggling to do their best. You know, whether we saw it or not, I think especially in troubled families, there was perhaps a tendency of the parents to try to shield the children from, you know, the dynamic that was going on, when in fact, you know, kids know. They always know, you know. And especially if they're getting hosed, you know, if they're not being, they aren't being straight up with them, that just makes it that much worse, because then you get into a situation of, who do you trust, you know, or can you trust anyone? So yes, we go forth from what we had hoped was going to be a place of sanctuary and shelter and safety, even though maybe it wasn't, and we get thrust out into this world, oftentimes with a real sense of anxiety or not being well grounded or whatever. I was interested in the dialogue that was happening, you know, about a century or so ago, between Freud and Carl Jung about that. You know, because Freud had this view that, in his views on religion, somewhat skeptical to put it mildly, you know, what he was basically positing was that, you know, as a child matures and as they realize they are going to get thrust out of the home and the place of safety and stability and sanctuary and being cared for, and then and they go out into the world alone and unprotected, and that in his view what happens is that people get together and they posit or hypothesize a replication of the home, you know, in the form of a religious doctrine or canon, and in the form of deities to be worshipped, you know, as we're parents, you know. That basically the whole thing is kind of a fairy tale. It gets made up by people to try to assuage these longings that never, that were go unrequited once we reach adulthood. So not a particularly charitable view, you know, of most religious traditions. Jung was coming at it from a different direction, and I think maybe has a little, and he was actually quite interested in Buddha Dharma, actually. And his view is that, you know, there's this notion of collective consciousness and a collective unconscious, and that there lies within each of us, and the Dalai Lama said that, you know, that our, it's our joy is our spiritual birthright, you know, that just as we have the propensity, if the need for sense gratification and wariness of threat and whatnot gets out of hand, it can blossom into greed, hate, and delusion. You know, so are these other qualities of the heart mind lying within the consciousness waiting to be awakened, and that they in fact can be collectively awakened through ritual and through inner exploration. He also, of course, said once that religious institutions are a protection against religious experience. So in this other view, there is great power, in fact, in Sangha, you know, in coming together for the recognition and the realization of the possibility of bringing forth these qualities, you know, and of bringing them forth in ourselves and recognizing them when they come forth in another, of giving them language, of giving them words, of recognizing them for what they are. In the theistic traditions, it's done by, you know, reaching out, by praying to an external deity. And it's a bit of a conundrum or a koan when it comes to Buddha Dharma. And Tara writes about that in her book here. I want to read some passages from it. She said, students of Buddhist practice often wonder if prayer, you know, kind of beseeching or asking for help, you know, may, even if it's like in the form of metta, you know, may I be, who are you asking me I be happy? You know, where's that directed? She said, students of Buddhist practice often wonder if this kind of prayer reinforces the notion of a separate and wanting self. We do seem to be beseeching someone or something greater than our small and frightened self. And who exactly are you praying to? I grew up in a Unitarian, and I remember how we used to joke about addressing our prayers to whom it may concern. Following the path of the Buddha, we may ask the same question. You know? While prayer does suggest a dualism of self and other, it can also be a direct path to the non-dual experience of fully belonging. Although not always highlighted in the West, prayer and devotion are actually a living stream in Buddhism. The earnest wish expressed in the practice of loving kindness and compassion, may I be happy, may be free from pain and suffering, are in fact forms of prayer. Our prayers of aspiration and our longing for relief from suffering may not necessarily be directed to anyone or anything, but we might also address them to the Buddha or one of the other great teachers or bodhisattvas we regard as embodiments of the awakened heart and mind. When done with mindfulness and sincerity, this kind of devotional prayer becomes a way to awaken our own heart and mind. So, John Donahue, the Celtic poet, wrote, "Prayer is the voice of longing. It reaches outward and inward to unearth our ancient belonging." This is a beautiful description of what I call mindful prayer. We reach not just outward to know our belonging, but with mindful prayer we also turn inward and listen deeply to the suffering that is giving rise to our prayer. When we are willing to touch the pain of separation, our longing carries us to the tender and compassionate presence that is our awakened nature. So, when you travel in Buddhist countries, or go to the Thai Wat here in Denver for that matter, you know, you see images. Most of you only see images of the Buddha and representing different aspects of Buddha nature. And the Mahayana practice in Chinese Buddhism is where the icon of Kuan Yin comes from, the Bodhisattva of compassion. Yeah. In Tibetan Buddhism, white Tara, or green Tara. There are actually 21 different Taras, different colors standing for different things. But essentially, Tara is the Bodhisattva of compassion and compassionate actions in Tibetan Buddhism. So, is this an external deity or not? Jung would say no. And in fact, in certain forms of Tibetan practice, certain visualization meditations, the idea behind any image like this, whether it's Tara or Kuan Yin or one of the others, is that they serve as kind of a reminder, okay, like a string around your finger, sort of something that lies within. It's a way to give the mind something to focus on as a way to remember an inner quality. It's a way to help bring an inner quality outward. Okay. And in some visualization practices in Tibetan practice, what one is encouraged to do through studying a tanka, a depiction of a particular deity or bodhisattva, and it's to study the figure, to do chants, to reflect on the qualities of mind that that image is thought to portray. Okay. And then you focus on those qualities in that image, and then the next step in it is that you become that deity, that bodhisattva, whatever it is that you've been projecting these thoughts and images and understandings onto. And then you draw that being back into yourself so that you become one with what that image is. And the last step is you dissolve it. Like pricking a balloon with a pin. So it has that effect, drawing it forth, focusing on it, remembering that that's an aspect of your very own consciousness, not only of your own, but of everybody's. Okay. And then bringing it back into yourself again. So that's the real value of an image like a Kuan Yin or a Tara, whatever. And it's of the four Brahma Viharas, it's the one of compassion, you know, of learning how to reparent, is what Tara calls it, you know. How to be to yourself the parent you wish you'd had but didn't. in Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest meditation master, you know, used to talk sometimes about what he called the one who knows. You know? And sometimes people didn't quite get it when he would say that, you know, is there kind of some like little genie or ghost or something running around in there, you know, playing wingman to your consciousness. And what he was basically trying to get at was this sense of inner wisdom, you know. Like when you hear a Dharma talk, you read something, and you know it's the first time you ever heard it or read it, and yet it sounds familiar, you know. What's going on is that you're simply being reminded of something that at some level you already knew to be so, you know. And so when we do what Tara calls mindful prayer, you know, may I live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm, you know. May I be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. May I liberate the joy that is within me and be happy. May I rest in silence and stillness and know peace of mind. May I rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. We are parenting ourselves when we do that. We're providing that place of sanctuary, that place of safety. We're providing for ourselves that sense of caring that we so longed for when we were young. Okay. And so in that way, the maturation of spiritual practice is about this, it's about, you know, developing this Kalyanamita, spiritual friend, you know, simply strengthening, allowing to come forth, acknowledging, being grateful for these qualities that lie within. And this, you know, these gestures of summoning forth, you know, they are most authentic and most genuine, it seems to me, and in my experience and others, is when they, to some extent, are grounded in what is, especially in terms of compassion, if you're willing to be grounded in any suffering that you might find in yourself or in others. The Sufi master, Pir Vilayat Khan, has this teaching that he has offered, where he says, overcome any bitterness that may have come because you are not up to the magnitude of the pain that was entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, each one of us is part of her heart and therefore endowed with a certain measure of cosmic pain. And then Tara writes, understanding that the pain in our life is an expression of universal suffering opens us up to the fullness of radical acceptance. Rather than being a problem, our depression, our fear, and anger are entrusted to us and can be dedicated to our awakening. When we carry our pain with kindness of acceptance instead of the bitterness of resistance, our hearts become an edgeless sea of compassion. We, like the mother of the world, become the compassionate presence that can hold with tenderness the rising and passing waves of suffering. That's it for a moment. May we all live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we liberate the joy that lies within us and be happy. May we rest in silence and stillness. No true peace of mind. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. May we awaken and be free. night, everybody. Have a safe journey back to your warm houses.